You're tuned into The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us. Yesterday on this show, we focused our entire hour on the Me Too movement against sexual discrimination and assault. We talked to farm workers who gave you ideas for making it less likely that the people who pick the produce on your table are victims of systemic sexual assault. We talked to women who began their careers decades ago, and we talked to parents of the next generation of men. And you'll find our whole discussion with links and resources at our website, kuow.org. Now, here's another take on modern feminism. The humorist Fran Lebowitz is coming here to Seattle in a couple of weeks to Benaroya Hall. She's been one of America's best-known writers for 40 years. I asked Fran Lebowitz what she makes of the Me Too movement.
I mean, basically, I think it's great. You know, I think it's great. Of course, I'm certain there's going to be things wrong with it because the Me Too movement, unfortunately, is made up of human beings, a flawed species. But I think it's fantastic. It's something I never... It's as much a surprise to me as a Trump presidency. Because if you're a woman, which also means you are a girl, you know, this is one of these things that you just thought would always be the same. You thought it was immutable. So, you know, it's very surprising to me, and it's a welcome surprise as opposed to the Trump presidency.
Yeah, you said that you could imagine racism ending someday, but that it's hard to imagine sexism ending. What do you mean by that?
What I meant by that is that racism is totally a fantasy. It's a fantasy of racial superiority. It's, you know, it's a total fantasy. So something that is completely made up, you could imagine at some point people would give up this idea. But there is a biological basis to sexism. You know, there is such a thing as testosterone. And it actually, testosterone is not anyone's fault. But, you know, if you replaced every single one of these men who got fired recently or resigned or whatever, if you replaced every single one with women, you would get bad bosses. I mean, there are female bosses that are bad, but you wouldn't get any of this behavior because the behavior is 100% male. And it's 100% male because it is attached to masculinity. Not all men are like this. I'm not saying that. But all people like this are men. So that's why I could not imagine sexism ending. And this is not an ending of sexism, by the way.
Well, you say there that, yes, there are biological differences, but why is there a biological basis to not just differences, but to sexism?
Because sexism is, you know, there's no such thing as like reverse sexism, just the way, by the way, in my opinion, there's no such thing as reverse racism, because it's allied to testosterone, which is, as we know, a hormone. Don't ask me what a hormone is, but some sort of chemical in the human body, or in fact, I believe in all animals, but I could be wrong. And one of the aspects of this is aggression, is competitiveness, is a show of strength or power, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, although women have some small amount of this, it is obviously prevalent in men. And that is why I mean that. You know, now sexism, or you could call it misogyny, whatever you want to call it. There is, as I said, this biological basis. It doesn't mean you have to act on it. You know, but I mean, that was the point, I suppose, some point of civilization. And some of this stuff, I mean, that, you know, that's come to light or that's been publicized, some of it is surprising, but none of it is as surprising to women as it is to men. I've had many more men say, I can't believe this. Do you think this is true? And into almost every single thing I said, yes, I do think it's true. Not because every single one of these things happened to me, most of them did not, but because they happened to people I know and because I'm a woman. And I know what that means. So, you know, I don't think men are ever going to wholly understand this, especially the men who don't do this, but they're just going to have to take the women's word for it.
You said that young men are a billion times better than old men, but young men are probably as good as they're going to get.
Well, I hope they might get a little better, or maybe the younger ones will. A younger men are a billion times better than men my age or older. I mean, not that there are that many men older than me anymore, but they're a billion times better because they were raised differently. You know, not because they have less testosterone. I don't want to insult them. I know they're very proud of this. But because they had different upbringing. It's not just the way men were raised. It's also the way women used to be raised. I mean, when I was a girl, a child, the absolute explanation to millions of things you might ask your parents was because you're a girl.
Yeah.
You know, why can't I do this? Because you're a girl. Can I do that? No, because you're a girl. How come so-and-so can do it? He's a boy. And no one countered that. You know, oh, okay, that's the way life is. Guys who are like 20 now or 30 or 35 were, you know, not all, but largely not raised like that, and neither were girls. So, yes, it absolutely has gotten better. And all these guys who got caught, none of them were 20. You know, so we hope that when the 20-year-olds, you know, get to, you know, positions of power, that they will not be like these other guys.
So you were a girl, you got told because you're a girl, how did you avoid the, we've been talking about this for weeks. This local writer I interviewed was telling me about women feeling obligated to go along, especially men too, but especially women, obligated to go along with somebody else's program because that's called being polite. Are you polite?
Have you not noticed how polite I am?
How did you avoid the deference?
I didn't wholly. You don't wholly avoid it. In a way, a certain lucky thing that happened to me was that till maybe 15 years ago, I never really thought of things that happened to me in relation to my gender. And I just thought it had to do with me. It wasn't until maybe 15 years ago that I realized that a lot of it, or some of it at least, had not to do with me as an individual, but with my gender. And in a way, I have to say, I think that was a lucky thing.
Like what, Fran? What are we talking about?
All kinds of things. Like, you know, of course, at the moment, none spring to mind. They will occur to me the second I leave here. I just didn't think about it. I skipped it. The only kind of activism I was ever involved with was anti-war activism, you know, of the Vietnam War. And the reason I was never involved with it was because I never thought it would work. It never occurred to me that any of this stuff would work. And so, you know, decided, let's not devote your life to something that's never going to work. And so I didn't, you know, even though I have to say that often I am complimented for activism that I absolutely was not involved with. So I never fought for any of these things. It never occurred to me they would work. I was for them in the sense that, yes, that would be a fantastic idea. I just never thought it would happen. And, you know, largely things in regard to women did not. I mean, gay rights far surpassed women's rights in like what seemed to me like 2 seconds. And when I say like 2 seconds, I mean, being gay was basically the same in like 1780, you know, 1880, 1980, you know, up until almost 5 minutes ago. It's like a roller coaster. You know, it goes slowly up and then all of a sudden it hurtles down. The idea, for instance, of gay marriage. Very often kids will say to me, I know you fought for this your whole life. And I always say, I never fought for it at all. It never even occurred to me. I never thought about it. It would have seemed like a joke, those two words together. I never thought about it 1 second. But those kind of rights absolutely have surpassed. You know, and I think one of the reasons for that is because half the gay people are men. You know, if it had been just women, I don't think it would have succeeded as much.
Hmm. So you get credit for activism that you had nothing to do with.
Absolutely.
Why is that? What is that about you?
I think that, you know, kids don't really, you know, first of all, it's astonishing to me that at a moment when everybody except me has a little machine that will tell them absolutely everything that ever occurred, that they don't seem to use it for that.
You don't have a computer?
I don't have a computer. I don't have a phone. I don't have whatever these other things are. No.
That's a strong choice. What's behind that?
It sounds, I know, it sounds like a stance. It seems like a stance.
Especially the whatever these things are part.
Because there's so many of them,
yeah.
But they're all the same, right? I mean, they're all computers of some kind. I don't have them because when they first invented a computer that you would have in your house, you know, as opposed to something, you know, IBM had, it was called a word processor. And a friend of mine got one, a friend of mine who is a screenwriter, and she'd have to come to my house and see this thing is fantastic. And I looked at it and I thought, this is just a very fast kind of typewriter. I never had a typewriter. I always wrote with a ballpoint pen. I am such a slow writer that I could write in my own blood without hurting myself. And I thought, I don't need this. I don't know how to type, which I don't. I didn't, of course, realize the entire world would go into one of these machines, but I still don't know how to type. And what I see people doing all the time is a kind of typing. And as soon as they really completely finish inventing that you can speak into it and it rapidly types everything out, perhaps I'll get one. But I have an incredible antipathy to machines in general. So that's why I never had a typewriter.
I don't know whether you just somehow are immune to what we call FOMO, the fear of missing out. You know, this a lot of people just could not imagine not participating in what everybody else is participating in. Or you could call it a lack of curiosity, Fran. I don't know, but what is that about you?
Well, I don't believe I have a lack of curiosity.
I didn't think so.
But I certainly have a lack of interest in what other people are doing. I have to say that. You know, I don't care what they're doing. I don't care what they think. I don't care what they think of what I think. That is probably the primary thing. I don't care whether people agree with me or not. I'm not running for anything. It's not that I don't care what people think of me as a human being, but I only care what people think of me as a human being if I know the person. This idea that who do you care about, on the internet, every single human being in the world, I can't imagine anything more exhausting and less remunerative.
Do you pay any price for that? Because I think of you as wildly popular. What's life like being you?
I've only been myself, so I don't know what it's like to be other people. I can assure you, by the way, that I am far from America's sweetheart. There are plenty of people who don't like me, and how do I know this? People yell at me in the street. People will cross entire restaurants to come up and tell me that they don't like something I said, something that continues to astonish me, even though it's been happening to me for like 40 years. I'm constantly places where I see people whose work I don't like. I don't cross a room to tell them, so that I'm not actually that big on going out of my way, I have to say. So it's not confined to that. Do I pay a price for it? Perhaps. I mean, for instance, there have been many times in my life where I have really wished I was the mayor of New York. And I know I could not be the mayor of New York because I know that I could not win probably even this room, even though I am alone in this room.
Writer Fran Lebowitz coming to Benaroya Hall in February. I want to check in because Seattle's changed so much. I don't know if anyone else, if people in New York know or care about the Seattle boom, but it's really built up here. And 5 years ago, you said Seattle was ruining New York. And I wondered what you meant by that and if you have any more Seattle thoughts since.
That's the last time I was in Seattle. I couldn't remember. I'm surprised it was that long ago. See, that's the thing about being old. You think everything was a shorter time ago. There certainly has been a homogenization of the country. I'm not certainly, one of a million people who has noticed that. The thing I most remember about the first time I went to Seattle, which I don't remember when that was, but it was probably 40 years ago, or maybe it wasn't the first time, but Seattle's the first place that I remember that seemed to be obsessed with coffee. And Seattle was also one of the earlier cities that institute a lot of no smoking laws. And I remember noticing, first of all, that you could get coffee every 3 feet, no matter where you were, but that you couldn't smoke anywhere. So I thought, what is this coffee for? Because to me, these things are absolutely intertwined. They are totally linked. I'm certain that if I ever stopped smoking, I would stop drinking coffee. I don't see the point of one without the other.
Seattle was known, I've been here that long, for decades, and Seattle used to be known for coffee shops, and now I think we're known for Starbucks. It feels different. Back then, we were known for grunge and coffee and rain, but it felt like I understood why. It felt like a deep part of us. And now, with so many more newcomers from all over the place, which I think is overall a good thing, I feel less sure of what do we all think about coffee and rain? Who are we? Maybe New York has always felt this way, but I don't know Seattle anymore.
Well, I mean, no matter where you live, it's different from when you were younger. there are certain periods that where that accelerates. I don't think I was in New York for a month before I was complaining, what happened to that building? They knocked that building down. The one that was been there forever, that was there 4 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So that, yes, and these things, of course, get worse, more accelerated and more homogenized. Because, first of all, there's a lot more travel than there used to be. By travel, I mean tourism, So people go more places and they affect those places. I, who am known here for being a hater of tourists, think that the problem with a lot of tourists in a place is that the place then caters to tourists as opposed to the residents, or as I put it, the citizens. And so that, a place that has a lot of tourists becomes more a place of tourists than it does the place a tourist came to see to begin with.
Yeah, that might be happening out here. I have one more question that just it's personal to me because I heard you talk about how hard school was for you. Algebra ruined your life. And we didn't probably have the same experience, but it sounds very similar to mine. I was put in accelerated programs, and I just fell apart, and it took me decades to put myself back together. And I've got a kid who doesn't want to take a test, whether she would pass it or not. She doesn't want to take one of these tests to put her in some highly capable program. She says, I want to be a kid, Dad. I'm 10 years old. I want to dance and read and have a childhood. So knowing nothing about my daughter, Fran Lebowitz, I thought of you. I wanted to know, should we make our kids be in fast-track classes, whether they care or not?
Well, first of all, they didn't have those when I was a child.
No?
No. I mean, I was a child in the 1950s. When I was a child, they never asked children a single thing. Okay? This is probably why I love answering questions from the audience, because no one ever asked me a question when I was a child. All children got when I was a child were, you know, directions, instructions from morning to night. I mean, I could tell you that I would like kind of sum up my childhood like this. I would say to my mother, can I please have an apple? And my mother would say, may I please have an apple? And I would say, may I please have an apple? And she would say, no. I certainly wouldn't have had the presence of mind or certainly the temerity to, you know, tell my mother how I wanted my childhood to be.
Was that a better way to raise kids, with not asking them their opinion?
I don't think so, because it was very frustrating. You know, I mean, it was angering. I don't think so. I think it's a very bad idea to imagine children are not humans. On the other hand, you know, it can be excessive. I mean, people ask their children questions that they could not possibly have the answer to, you know. Oh, I've heard people ask their children where they want to go to school. Like, if you're still going to school, you can't be in charge of that.
Fran, anything else you want to tell Seattle, Washington here before you you show up and pop off?
I didn't realize I was in charge of telling the people in Seattle what to do. Be nicer to smokers.
Yeah?
Yes.
We expunged people like you. Isn't that the healthy thing to do?
Well, you know, I'm still alive. I know that irritates some people, but I'm still here.
Are you going to come here and defy our smoking laws?
No, I'm not going to defy the laws.
No.
But I'm not going to stop smoking. You're still allowed to smoke outside there, are you not?
You are.
Yeah.
You are, but not in the parks.
That's okay. I would have no reason to go to a park.
Okay, we will not be taking you to the Cascade Mountain Range.
I appreciate that.
Fran Lebowitz, American humorist, coming to Benaroya Hall, the Mark Taper Foundation Auditorium, on Sunday, February 18th at 7:30. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I didn't get a chance to ask Fran Lebowitz about this proposal to make Sasquatch our official state cryptid with the license plate to boot. We'll talk about that in just a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. Now, on with the news. News of Bigfoot. You know, Bigfoot might not be real, but he's a heck of a fundraiser. We are fascinated with that critter, and now a Washington State senator wants to harness that fascination to maintain Washington State parks. Senator Ann Rivers from the Vancouver area wants to make Sasquatch our state's official cryptid. Cryptid. A cryptid is a creature whose existence has not been proven by science and has not been disproven by science. That's Bigfoot. Senator Rivers also would like an official $40 Washington State Sasquatch-themed license plate that would raise money for state park maintenance. She says, quote, assuming Sasquatch is a native Washingtonian and our state parks are part of Sasquatch's native habitat, it makes perfect sense to capitalize on Sasquatch's popularity in a way that would help protect and improve that habitat. My next guest is an expert in the fundraising, the money-making potential of Bigfoot / Sasquatch. My guest is Bob Bishop, who is a wholesaler of Bigfoot and Sasquatch souvenirs. Welcome, Bob.
Well, nice to be with you, Bill.
What's the difference between Bigfoot and Sasquatch?
Well, they're kind of used interchangeably. Sasquatch is up in Canada. The Canadians actually had a postage stamp in honor of Sasquatch commemorative. But down here in the States, I would say that Bigfoot is the more popular name.
More popular. What, and Yeti, where does Yeti fall?
Yeti, that's more the foreign area. We start getting into old Russia and some of the Mideastern, they have their version. And Yeti is one of the terms they use.
And you use Bigfoot?
Yes.
Got it.
We'll also use Sasquatch. There, some of our customers prefer Sasquatch, so we will accommodate them.
Okay, established that. We've established that now. And I said you're in the business. You're a wholesaler. How did you get into the Bigfoot Sasquatch business now for more than 20 years?
Well, way back in the late 1980s, I was at a gift show in San Francisco, a souvenir-type gift show, and worked for a souvenir company. And a lady approached me. She had a store in Willow Creek, California. And Willow Creek, even at that time, called itself the Bigfoot capital of the world.
Well, remind us why Willow Creek thinks it's the Bigfoot capital.
Well, the famous Patterson-Gimlin film was shot about 30, 40 miles from Willow Creek, and that was about 50 years ago. They just had their 50th anniversary. So Willow Creek, of course, being the nearest small town, they have publicized themselves as the Bigfoot capital of the world. And this lady with the gift shop there on a major highway wanted to have Bigfoot items for the tourists that came through, and she couldn't find any. So she asked me about it. I talked to the boss. He was kind of lukewarm about it.
As bosses burner. Sometimes yeah. are about Bigfoot.
Yes, for sure. He was a skeptic. And so I kind of renewed the idea after I had left the company, early 90s or thereabouts, and have been with it ever since.
And what is the demand like for Sasquatch Bigfoot products?
Well, in certain areas, very heavy. I'll give you an example. Right up there in Washington, not that far from you, the film, Harry and the Hendersons, that you might recall from about 30 years ago.
I do.
Okay, well, that was filmed up there, a town close to Index, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely a wooded area there in the Cascades somewhere. I've not been there. But there's a espresso coffee-type shop there, and they publicize a lot of Bigfoot items. They're very popular. There's a store in California, Legend of Bigfoot. They do really well, too. And so in the niches, certain niches, Bigfoot is very popular. I understand Branson now will have a Bigfoot on the strip.
Branson, Missouri.
Yes, indeed.
That Bigfoot gets around.
He really moves around. Well, with those that long stride of his, he covers a lot of area.
That's true. That helps. And as you heard, we're not that impressed in Washington State with the Willow Creek origin story, to the point where our state is considering making a Sasquatch, as it's called here sometimes, the official cryptid of our state. What is your top Sasquatch seller?
Well, the old basic T-shirt.
Yeah.
The tourists love to wear their T-shirts, as well as even the locals. And we have one in particular that glows in the dark. And it's got a silhouette of Bigfoot, and the text on it is Bigfoot Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that one has been our bestseller.
Do you have any limits that you put on yourself as far as how you depict Bigfoot?
Well, there are probably several hundred, many different versions, and it depends upon the artistic sense of the individual creating
okay.
Bigfoot, and they're all over the ballpark.
All over. Anything goes. I mean, do you have a kind of a limit for yourself? You say, hey, come on, Bigfoot is not this and it's not that. Let's agree on what Bigfoot is, because it's not doing everything. You know, you're okay with glowing in the dark, I see.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So what about this license plate idea? You're a wholesaler of Bigfoot items. Any advice to Washington State as we consider an honorary $40 license plate?
Yes, I would say that the idea is good. I think that, getting back to your question about art, I have not seen a concept. I assume that there'll be careful deliberations about the choice of graphic used, that somehow a silhouette of Bigfoot, I'm not sure what they have in mind, but I hope it's an attractive plate, because otherwise people won't buy it to put on their car, even though the cause might be good, donating to your state parks. So I think the design of the plate would be important. And going back to your question about Sasquatch versus Bigfoot, that might be something to really consider.
Mm-hmm. Bob Bishop, founder of Bishop Custom Products in Orland, California. You've been in the Sasquatch Bigfoot wholesale business for more than 20 years. Are you a believer?
Let me put it this way. I'm not a non-believer. In my mind, the jury is still out on this one.
The jury is out. What would it take for the jury to be in on Bigfoot?
Oh, I would say capturing a Bigfoot would certainly remove all doubt.
That would help.
That would sure help. I would say some of these hair samples. There could be some proof there.
But no one's ever going to think, oh, Bigfoot has finally been debunked. I can't imagine.
No. I think it ranks right along with the UFOs. There will always be believers, and I think that's kind of what makes it fun and interesting.
Bob Bishop makes a good living in part off that fun we have with Bigfoot and Sasquatch. He's the founder of Bishop Custom Products in Orland, California, selling other stuff, but supplying Sasquatch products to shops around the Pacific Northwest and California. Bob, good to talk with you.
Well, likewise, Bill. Enjoyed it very much.
I enjoyed it too. Again, the Washington State Senator Ann Rivers in our legislature here in Olympia is proposing that Sasquatch be our state's official cryptid, a character not proven or disproven to exist by science, and there would be a $40 Sasquatch license plate. $40, and 28 of those would go to support Washington State public park programs. We'll be back with more of The Record in just a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This week, United Airlines turned away a ticketed passenger from a flight. The would-be traveler was a peacock named Dexter, whose owner called him an emotional support animal. Airlines say they are seeing escalating abuse of that term, emotional support animal. In fact, the Washington legislature is now considering a $250 fine on people who misrepresent a service animal and bring this animal into pet no-go zones. I'm going to chat with a couple people about how that works in cities. But first, let's just tell you more about Dexter the Peacock. We have with us Taylor Garland, Public Relations Coordinator for the Association of Flight Attendants. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Bill. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. What happened with Dexter the Peacock?
So Dexter the Peacock was a alleged emotional support animal. United had actually contacted the passenger multiple times before she arrived at the airport to tell her that they wouldn't be able to accommodate the peacock.
Why not? How could a peacock not be an emotional support animal?
It is the DOT lays out a few guidelines for things outside of the normal realm. Normally you see dogs, cats, things like that as emotional support animals. They outline things like snakes and rodents as animals that would fit the category outside of that. And so they tried to warn the passenger, and she unfortunately still showed up to the airport with the peacock and was denied boarding.
Well, how do you document that your animal is an emotional support animal?
So what we've seen is that, and the real issue here is the abuse in the system. People who really need these animals, especially the service animals, you're able to tell that these are real service pets or service animals.
How can you tell?
You know, with service animals, there's normally a person with disability. They're blind, deaf, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional support animals, likely they will have a letter from a therapist or things like that. And that's where we see the most abuse, that people are going online. If you simply Google, you're able to find a therapist or psychologist that will write this letter for you for $200 that will supposedly allow you to take these animals and travel with them on planes. And it's not just on planes, it's other places in public.
Oh, and you there's the documentation, you asked for it, they present it. Are you not allowed to override that?
Well, it gets to a point with ADA rights, and that's why we want to weed out some of this abuse in the system. And we've asked the DOT to play a larger role in this and kind of define better policies and procedures to make sure that the people who are bringing the emotional support animals on the plane are really emotional support animals, and they've been trained to provide some service to the passenger.
Okay. What are some of the animals that you've heard about somebody trying to bring on board besides dogs and cats?
Dogs and cats, miniature ponies can also actually be trained as service animals, but we've seen things like emotional support pigs, roosters, ducks, all different types of dogs, kangaroos, a sloth, anything, you name it.
And what is so wrong if Norman, the emotional support duck, gets on the plane or what have you? What's the problem here?
So, one, the aircraft cabin is a confined space, and we want to make sure that all passengers and the legitimate service and emotional support animals in our care are safe, healthy, and secure for that flight. But when you have animals on board who are not properly trained to be in these types of conditions, there are safety risks like biting other passengers or biting other service animals. There are health risks with animals defecating or urinating in the cabin, along with people with allergies. And then there are also security risks, because when there's any kind of chaos or distraction in the cabin, it creates a security issue. Not to mention, the planes are fuller than ever. There's more passengers on board. The seats are smaller. And flight attendants have to deal with de-escalation every day. And this is another point of contention between passengers on the plane.
Right. You got enough to do without de-escalating a peacock.
Correct.
Taylor Garland does public relations for the Association of Flight Attendants. Thanks for filling us in, Taylor.
Thanks so much.
Again, as I said, Washington State is considering putting a $250 fine on the misrepresentation of emotional support animals. And Taylor was just telling us that these days you can go online and get somebody to write you up a document that you have an emotional support animal, but the flight attendants would like to see the Federal Department of Transportation get involved and be more rigorous about how you document your emotional support animal. So that's in the air. What about down here? Seattle's got a lot of dogs. Very dog-friendly city here. There are two dogs for every child, I've read, in Seattle. Shouldn't you be able to take Rover wherever you go? You're not making a flight attendant de-escalate your peacock. Let's talk about this with the head of Citizens for Off-Leash Areas. That's a Seattle group that wants to expand the public areas for dogs in the city. Cole Eckerman, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today.
And also with us, Sanaz Eftekeri, am I saying that right?
You are, yes.
Sanaz,
hi,
is the
thanks for having me.
Thank you. You're the Director of Corporate Affairs for the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. And Sanaz, you say that pet exposure isn't just about culture, it's about safety?
For some people with asthma or allergic asthma, it can be a health issue as well.
How much bending of the rules do you see in the Seattle area from dog owners?
From me personally?
Yes, Sanaz, yeah.
We're a national organization, so I don't have data for the Seattle area.
Uh-huh.
But just overall nationally, we do see some bending of the rules, especially when it does come to airline passengers.
Yes.
And we've heard stories from our constituents and from people who have asthma and allergies. We've heard different stories, and we've been gathering those stories.
And Cole Eckerman, you want to expand access to public areas, including off-leash areas for dogs. Why is that?
Yeah, so we really view dogs as community builders. You know, unless you're Eclipse, the bus riding dog, the dog doesn't take itself to the dog park. The owner does that. When somebody has a dog, it's really an encouragement for them to get out of their house and meet the people that make up their community. And providing access to public spaces just really helps to encourage that and foster the sense of community.
So, Sanaz, do you have any problem with more access to public areas for dogs, expanding community, as Cole described?
I think it just depends on the person. For the people that we serve, just as a patient advocacy organization, there are people whose sensitivities to pet dander can really give asthma symptoms or allergy symptoms like shortness of breath and wheezing and coughing. And for those people, it can be a health risk. I think one of the things I'd really love for people to keep in mind is that if somebody does have a true allergy to pet dander, it's not necessarily a preference. You know, it's something that does impact their health.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes being in a close space with pets can trigger some of their symptoms. But we always just give people tips on how to avoid exposure to those triggers. But, you know, it would help if they didn't have the, close proximity to some animals.
Cole Eckerman, we were just talking about the problem of people basically faking their emotional support animals. Do you think that really is a problem?
I do think it's a problem. You know, people have emotional support animals and therapy animals for very serious reasons, whether it's PTSD or a dog that helps somebody with hearing or a dog that can sense somebody having a seizure. There are very legitimate reasons for having a service animal. And when people fake having a service animal, they delegitimize those folks that really need it. And that's doing them a big disservice. So we definitely encourage folks, don't fake having a service animal. Only claim your dog or your cat or your therapy animal is a therapy animal if it actually is.
You know, I mentioned how many dogs we have in the Seattle area. I've heard the number two dogs for every child. And
yep.
Yeah, and I've been around in Seattle for decades now, but it's a changing place. More people coming in, new people coming in, less space in the Seattle area. Are you seeing any less love for the free-ranging dog, Cole?
Oh, no, there is definitely more love for dogs coming up in the city. We see a lot of the new breweries that are starting, the tap rooms. A lot of those are dog-friendly or unofficially dog-friendly. One thing that we would really like to see is if businesses could kind of make that call as to whether or not they're dog-friendly, because if they're able to tell folks, then hopefully those folks that do have allergies make it, it'd be easier for them to avoid those locations where there are going to be animals.
Is there such a thing as too many dogs around?
As somebody that has almost the maximum amount of dogs in the city, I personally don't think there's too many dogs.
How many dogs do you have?
I have two dogs and one child.
Two dogs and one child. Okay, when you said maximum, I thought, wow, this is really going
to
get...
Well, you can have up to three dogs in Seattle, so we're getting close to that limit. Once the baby's a little bit older, we might venture back into three dogs again.
Wait a minute. There's a limit on how many dogs you can have in Seattle in one home?
Yes, you're only allowed to register up to three dogs.
I've lived here for 35, 40 years. I've never heard that in my life, that there was any limit on the number of any pets, including dogs.
Yep, that's the maximum amount that you're allowed to license for your home.
Sanaz, you're at the national level. Is that typical that we limit the number of animals that people can own?
You know what? I haven't heard that either, so that's new.
How about that? Why three? And three seems, I have zero dogs, but three seems kind of like a small number of dogs to me.
I've had three dogs before, and they varied in sizes from a Chihuahua to an English Mastiff, and it can be a little hectic when you have three, but it's all about growing with your pack size.
Well, what's the biggest problem of having too many dogs? Why do we have that law?
One of the biggest problems of having a lot of dogs is not having a space to really recreate them. You know, Seattle really is a town of urban villages. We don't all have single-family homes. Not everybody has a yard. So you have to rely a lot on public spaces to exercise your dog. Unfortunately, despite the fact that we have more dogs per capita than any city in North America, we also have one of the smallest allotments of legal off-leash land. Seattle only has 26 acres of legal off-leash land, and those are the dog parks we're talking about. The national average is 100 acres, so we're pretty far behind there.
Hmm. I have eight brothers and sisters, and I definitely used to get a lot of looks suggesting that maybe there should be a limit on the number of children one should have. I've personally experienced that reaction in restaurants. Sanaz Eftekhari from Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America, any final thoughts on what you want owners to think about when they head out with their dogs or other animals?
Yeah, if we're just talking on the travel front, we really just want people to be courteous of their fellow passengers and just keep in mind that some of the folks around you in the confined space, like an airplane, might have some sensitivities or allergies to the pet dander. So just be courteous. Just know that your fellow travelers can be impacted, and just maybe not bring in falsified service animals because, like Cole said, it does delegitimize people who do need it. And so we're just trying to reduce the amount of exposure that folks with asthma and allergies have.
Well, Sanaz, is there any argument to be made on behalf of the people who are bringing in their dogs without taking all the time and money to document the fact that this is an emotional support animal? I mean, is there an argument that, look, if I say this animal is vital to my emotional support, then believe me, you know, I'm traveling. I'm a lot of people are scared to fly, and it's a confined space.
Right.
And can you say anything? Would you want to say anything on behalf of the people who maybe fudge those requirements around bringing your beloved animal places?
I'm not sure I can make that argument, but one thing I would keep in mind is, you know, a true service animal or a support animal should be well trained and behaved, just in order to be courteous to the people around you and not increase the commotion on a confined space. So I'm not sure I have an argument on their behalf, but I think if they go through the proper channels to get that animal trained and well-behaved, then maybe there's an argument there.
Right. And that, again, that's Sanaz Eftekhari of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. Sanaz, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Cole Eckerman, I have a couple more questions for you, Citizens for Off-Leash Areas. I regularly, I'm sure you do too, hear complaints about, this reminds me of the bicycle discussion, right? You hear complaints about people who own dogs but also don't obey the letter of the law. The dogs run around, dogs on trails when you're hiking. People who have dogs, and I've had many, often seem to feel like the rules, sometimes feel like the rules don't apply to them. What do you say?
Well, we really see it from both sides. Seattle is kind of a difficult place to have this discussion because you do have so many dogs, and we have this reputation of being such a dog-friendly city, but that's really only true if you have a certain amount of money. If you can afford to go to the dog-friendly breweries, if you can afford a dog walker, if you can afford to send your dog to doggy daycare, or if you work in a dog-friendly workplace, it is one of the most dog-friendly cities in the country. However, if you're relying on public lands to exercise your animal or to socialize the animal and you can't afford the doggy daycares, it's a very different story. So on the one hand, we definitely want people to obey the leash and the scoop laws, especially the scoop laws. And we want people to make well-informed, educated decisions. But at the same time, we see that we have a system that is not meeting the needs. Like I said, we have more dogs per capita than any city in North America, but we have one of the smallest allocations of legal off-leash land. And we really need a system that is kind of right-sided there. Right now, there's roughly 14,000 dogs for every dog park in the city. That's way overcrowded, especially considering some of these dog parks are less than a tenth of an acre. We need more open spaces where our dogs can recreate.
There's only so much space. Are we talking about dog choosing between dogs and humans?
No. And we definitely never advocate for that. As somebody that has a kid, I totally understand the need of the playground and the baseball field. But another thing is the dog owners are about 20 to 30% of the population in the city, yet we're getting access to less than one tenth of a percent of the park's land. So we need to make sure that we are doing right by the taxpayers of the city. And part of that means giving people meaningful access to the public lands in the way that they want to access them.
We've been talking with Cole Eckerman, Executive Director of Citizens for Off-Leash Areas, a Seattle group that wants to expand the public areas for dogs in the city. And we heard from the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. And we even talked with the Association of Flight Attendants about people bringing in their ducks and roosters and miniature horses and kangaroos and pigs and peacocks, too. Cole, thanks for talking with us about all this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Back in a moment. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Some people are calling last night's presidential State of the Union address measured because President Trump didn't use all of his most controversial rhetoric. For one thing, Trump made no mention of abortion rights. Last year, Trump's White House angered abortion rights advocates when it cut off federal funding to Planned Parenthood. Boy, it is sure striking how different the abortion climate is just north of us. Canada's government supports abortion rights to the point that groups applying for federal money to provide summer jobs have to attest that they support a woman's right to choose. That's a new rule, and it does have its critics. Here to explain is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Good afternoon, Bill.
What does abortion have to do with summer jobs?
Many people are asking that these days because of a controversy the government's generated. So the Canadian government hands out a fair amount of money every year to hire students, $220 million. And generally they go to nonprofits and small business groups in Canadian constituencies. So members of parliament kind of oversee the dispensing of these checks. Last year, one group that was pro-life got a hold of some money and, in fact, I think used some of it to hire people to campaign to picket abortion clinics and so forth. And the backlash from that has been the addition of this clause that you just referred to, which is this year when groups apply, charities, nonprofit church groups apply for this money, they basically have to, Well, some people say they have to attest that they're pro-choice. They certainly have to disavow any possibility of being opposed to access to abortion or challenging access to abortion in the courts or disavowing it in any ways. And that has some groups, religious groups, church groups, and even free speech advocates saying that this requirement goes too far.
Yes. What is Prime Minister Trudeau and the Liberal government's defense of what to some people sounds like an infringement of, as you say, free speech?
Well, he says he's pro-choice and that the courts in Canada have recognized abortion rights and that people shouldn't be campaigning against it. A lot of what he says is true. There is no law against access to abortion in Canada. The courts threw it out 30 years ago, never been put back. And Canadians generally support access, but that's not really the issue here. It really is. Is he now saying that you can't even criticize it, that you can't even speak out against it, that groups that for religious reasons or other reasons might choose to have among their core beliefs that they would organize against this or even go to court, not deny access to abortion because that's against the law, but suppose you just want to try to persuade Canadians that we should have laws against some level of access. Well, the way the Prime Minister's government has worded this application for money, it could be that if your group was simply of the view that in the long run, third trimester abortion should be regulated, you would be running up against the Prime Minister's absolutist view, which is pro-choice.
It sounds like Prime Minister Trudeau and his allies on this are pointing out that, well, this isn't a blanket denial of free speech rights. Only a group's core mandate has to be in line with our country's legal reproductive rights. Core mandate. What is that meaning in practice?
Well, that's an area of debate. If you're, and I think that's where a number of Canadian churches right across the spectrum of belief have joined together and asked the government to narrow this or clarify it or make it less of a blanket restriction so that their religious groups, their Bible camps and so forth can apply. And so effectively, the criteria would allow the government to say, look, if you're going to go out there and hire people to pick at abortion clinics, forget it. You're not getting the money. But if you're simply a church group that takes the view that abortion is a sin or that there should be some restrictions on it or that in the long run you may wish to persuade Canadians to bring back some sort of law on this, that wouldn't run afoul of your ability to hire students for summer jobs, that you'd still be able to do that as long as I say, you didn't specifically hire people to picket an abortion clinic.
Yes, it seems to come down to lobbying, to picketing, and is that your group's core mandate, and should you be denied a federal funding? It's fascinating. Finally, Vaughn, do you have any prediction? Are you seeing any signals as to how this debate, and it's being debated here in the United States too. Plenty of, you know, Trump officials and Fox News, they're all over this. How do you think this is going to turn out in Canada?
The government shouldn't be stirring people up on this because I think the free speech advocates are right. They should listen to the church groups that are saying, look, just reword the application. Narrow it down to the specific problem you're trying to fix. Don't make it sound like you want to gag everybody that sees some merit in some restrictions on access to abortions. No one is suggesting we overturn the 30 years of court history or a woman's right to choose. All we're saying is there should be some free speech around this. There should be some right to criticize, even though, no question, in Canada, women have a right to access to abortion.
That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, thank you for breaking that down. Always good to talk with you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And that's it for today's edition of The Record on KUOW. Today's show is made for you by Amina Alsadi, Adjua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Always join us on Twitter at KUOW. Again, if you missed yesterday's discussion of the Me Too movement and its future, we have a great sort of build out on our website. Go to KUOW.org. You can see the people involved in that discussion. You can listen to the conversation. There are links and resources for you there at KUOW.org. We'll talk to you tomorrow.